All right, guys, time to go ahead and get started. Good to see you out this morning. Glad you guys could be here. And we are continuing our series on the Psalms, Praying Like the Psalmist. If you're our guest here this morning, that's what we've been going through on Sunday mornings. On Wednesday nights, we're also having this class, but instead of going through our Bible studies and the lesson books on Wednesday nights, we're focusing on prayer itself. And we get together and are led in prayer, and we sing some prayers, and then we break up into some groups and pray for one another. And so that's what we're doing. We'd love to have you be here and be a part of that on Wednesday night as we're putting into practice some of the things that we're learning with these Psalms. Today we are on lesson 6. If you have a class book, it's page 23. And if you're a guest, we'll have questions up on the screen so that you can follow along with us. And hopefully that'll be beneficial to you. We're going to go ahead and kick off with a prayer. And so I just got in here and didn't get anybody, so I'm just going to go ahead and kick us off with that. Father in heaven, thank you very much for this opportunity we have today to be in your presence with our brothers and sisters. Please be with us throughout this class as we learn more about ourselves and how we can see ourselves, perceiving our spiritual station so that we can pray with more fervency and intensity, with more devotion and connection to you. Thank you so much for giving us the Psalms from which we can learn as we see the saints who have gone before us, as they surrendered and submitted to you, as they cried out to you. Help us to learn from them things that will help us bring more honor and glory to you. Help us this morning as we learn from you through your word that we might lift you up in our lives. We also pray for the other classes that are taking place this morning, that you'll be with the instructors and the assistants, that they will remember what they've prepared and that they will share things that benefit the students. And we pray that the hearts and minds of each of the students in the classes this morning will be devoted to you because of what they hear. Father, we pray that everything we do here in this class brings honor to you. It's through your Son, Jesus, we pray. Amen. Okay, so lesson number 6 is seeing ourselves as the psalmist did. If you haven't been in the class, basically what we've looked at so far, we started off just studying why we would want to study the Psalms and hopefully gain some things that have excited us about this class. Then we talked about some things that would hopefully give us a little bit of relief from any of the fears that we might have about praying like the psalmist. Just pointing out that the Psalms are not some kind of standard that if you don't ever get to that level or pray just like them, that you're going to be lost. That's not the way it is. We talked about why we don't actually have to pray exactly like the psalmist, but we learned even in that lesson that there's a lot of good guidance and help. And then over the last two class periods on Sunday morning, we've been taking a look at God, the God of the psalmist, who they believed in, what they believed about him, and they recognized him as creator. They recognized him as judge. They recognized him as king and shepherd and the source and all those things that they learned about God, that if we gain that faith, if we grow in that faith, the natural reaction is going to be that we're going to pray. The more we believe in the God that the psalmists believe in, the more we're going to pray like the psalmist prayed. But now, as we consider more about how the psalmist prayed and why they prayed the way they did, there's not only some unique ideas that they had about God and his greatness and his power and his benevolence and his glory. There's also how they viewed themselves. If we don't view ourselves properly, we are not going to pray like the psalmist prayed. If we think too much of ourselves, guess what we're not going to do? We're not going to pray. If we think that we don't have needs, that we don't have dependence, guess what we're not going to do? We're not going to pray. And so we need to see how they viewed themselves. And there's two main things that we recognize in the psalmist. I'm sure we could look at all kinds of little tidbits throughout the Psalms to help us. But there are two main overarching principles that I hope we can recognize that I believe truly impacted why the psalmist prayed the way they did and as much as they did. And the very first thing that we recognize is that the psalmist saw themselves as sheep in need of a shepherd. Sheep in need of a shepherd. Now, of course, when we hear that, what's the first psalm we think of? Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. They saw themselves as sheep in need of a shepherd. But there are other psalms that mention this sheep-shepherd relationship. And then there's other psalms that, even though it doesn't necessarily say sheep, it presents that exact same kind of picture that a sheep with its shepherd is. And so hopefully we'll be able to cover some of that as we look at this. But as I was preparing the material, it was almost, I guess, providential. As I was looking for, you know, going through our Victorious blog and finding little pictures on Flickr to go along with that, saw this picture that just really irritated me. And it just said, only sheep need a shepherd. And I have no doubt that it was an anti-Christian picture. It was an anti-Christian placard as they were protesting whatever it was they were protesting. Only sheep need a shepherd. So what do you think they meant by that? Here we go. One over here and one over here. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I think a sign like this is somebody saying that I should be able to think for myself and I don't need some imaginary leader.
Okay. Sheep can't think for themselves. And only people who can't think for themselves need somebody who's a shepherd.
Only weak people need
weak,
a shepherd.
Only weak people. Weak. You Christians are just weak. Anybody else? What do you think they meant by this? Back there.
Well, sheep all tend to follow each other. There's the herd mentality that's talked about. And, you know, people want to be individuals at any cost, pretty much.
Yeah, just a bunch of followers. Just a bunch of followers. Anybody else want to add? What do you think they meant by this? Only sheep need a shepherd. Yeah, so I think that hits on exactly what that person was trying to say is, I'm not weak. I don't need a shepherd. I'm not a follower. I don't need a leader. I don't need to be in the herd. I can be by myself. Only weak followers who can't think for themselves need a shepherd. And that's the problem with all you Christians. I think that's exactly what they're trying to point out. I'm going to come back to this in a later question and think about this a little bit more. But I think that's exactly what this person is trying to get across. I'm strong. I'm strong. I don't need a shepherd. I'm an individual. I don't need a flock. And you guys are weak because you're saying you need that shepherd. Go ahead, Kelly.
It's interesting that in that group, and there's obviously gazillions of them, many of them are scrambling to lead their own flock.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's the truth. That's the truth. Yeah, we can talk about some of the inconsistencies. It's amazing. We're talking about individualism. It's amazing how many people are individuals just like everyone else. And how, you know, as we, no, I'm going to be my own person like them. And we just see that sort of thing. And the desire for acceptance, the desire to be approved. Now, the reality is people who get out with signs like that are trying to get some type of something from someone, have some kind of recognition. And so that's, we can talk about some of the inconsistencies on all of that. And it does get kind of humorous if it wasn't so sad. But, you know, the fact is, if you're like me, when I first saw that sign, it kind of irritated me and it upset me. I was like, I'm not a sheep. What are you talking about? That was my kind of initial reaction. I wanted to kind of fight against it. But let's get back to that after we consider a couple more questions. So what do you know about sheep? Somebody just tell me about sheep. Flattering picture? Shane's going back. No, not at all. So tell me about sheep right down here.
They're very dependent on protection from someone else.
Dependent upon protection from someone else. In fact, they're pretty much helpless. There's just almost, they have almost no self-defense.
They're very stupid animals, and they'll follow each other into very dangerous situations, off the cliff, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, sheep, my understanding is sheep are not extremely intelligent creatures. You know, they don't think ahead. All they think is, where's the next tuft of grass coming from? Oh, there's some. Let me just climb off this cliff and fall to my death because I thought I saw some grass there. There's no ability to distinguish between here's good water to drink and here's bad water to drink. So, yeah, sheep are really dumb animals. Anybody else want to add? Here we go. Right.
They have to be led. They can't be herded from behind.
Okay, sheep have to be led. You're not going to push them. They have to be led.
Could be mistaken in this one, but I believe that if you let them stay in the same pasture long enough, they'll eat everything and there's nothing left. They'll destroy what they have.
Yes, that is exactly right. That sheep, again, they don't think ahead. It's just whatever, you know, I'm just going to eat. And, oh no, there's nothing left. Now I die. Go ahead.
It was interesting. We're talking about this because recently there was, I was just hearing some information about the government conducting genetically modifying sheep, an experiment supposed to continue on for 4 more years, trying to modify them so that they can tend to themselves, so that you can increase them with less labor from people. And they left them out to themselves, and they just couldn't do it. They died. They even tried to modify them, and they just couldn't do it.
That's hilarious. I had not heard about that. I mean, that's really sad for the sheep. That's just so sad. But yeah, I mean, that's the problem. We're even going to try to modify them, and they're still just going to be creatures that have no idea how to take care of themselves, and they need somebody who's going to take care of them. Go ahead.
Just a little FYI, the sheep are mentioned 500 times in the Bible, and more than any other animal. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So here's this really dumb, stupid, can't take care of itself animal. And the psalmists, I want you to notice in the psalmists, it's not God calling these people sheep. Who is it calling them sheep? They're calling themselves sheep. And I know that, you know, I've heard people talk about, oh, you know, this is what a wonderful, beautiful picture. You know, for David, it's a beautiful picture because he had been a shepherd. And, you know, I would think a shepherd probably knew exactly how dumb the sheep were. I mean, David took that name for himself. He was okay saying, I'm a sheep. And God is my shepherd. Go ahead.
I think they call themselves sheep because it's more of their relationship with God.
Okay.
How great God is, how dumb or helpless we are compared to God.
That's a perfect segue into the next question. So why would anyone think it's a positive thing to be a sheep? Here we go.
Although they're not very smart, they're of great value to the shepherd.
Okay, because a sheep is a great value to a shepherd. Are you holding your hand? I wasn't sure if that was reaching for the mic or not.
It's really blatantly spiritually honest about the human condition. When you really open your eyes and see the history of mankind and where we're going, we really do behave like sheep.
Yeah.
And unless we have a shepherd, we're going down.
That's absolutely right. So why is it a positive thing? It's just being honest. Being honest. It's positive to be honest. If we look honestly at the history of humanity, what do humans do? They act like sheep, including us. Go ahead.
I don't think it is a positive thing to be a sheep. I think, no, people are scum. That's the reality. And when you realize how much of a scum you are, then you realize how much you need God. It's not a matter of whether it's good or not.
Okay, yeah, it's not necessarily a positive or negative thing. It's just the reality, and we need to honestly recognize that. Go ahead.
There's some similarities, though, between sheep and children. I mean, they're both dependent. They both trust whoever's leading them. Children will do things, you know, for criminal parents because they don't know any better and they trust them. And that trust, I think, is kind of what endears sheep to the shepherd. You hear about how tender shepherds feel towards their sheep because they know the sheep trust them.
Yeah, and so the positive side of that is the trust of the shepherd, or the trusting the shepherd. Go ahead.
I think in the biblical sense, if we admit that we're sheep, we're also admitting we have a shepherd. And shepherd does not imply stupidity in the sheep. It implies that we need protection and we need guidance and leadership when we make bad choices.
Yeah, and that's, to me, the issue here, if we're looking for positives, why would they do this? Because the issue is not about us being sheep, but about God as shepherd. And you know what? It's not a bad thing to be a sheep if you've got a great shepherd. Now, if you've got a really rotten shepherd, talking about like the criminal parents that kids would follow, if you've got a really rotten shepherd, well, it's terrible to be a sheep. You're going to be defenseless. You're going to be hurting. You're going to destroy yourself. But when you've got a great shepherd, it's not so bad to recognize that we're a sheep. And so, you know, I saw that picture and my first reaction was to want to say, what are you talking about? I'm not just a sheep. And of course, it hit me. Wait a minute. I preach all these sermons about sheep with the loving shepherd and how great it is. And wow, now this guy has gotten me to say I'm not a sheep. But, you know, the problem there is that what it takes to say that I'm a sheep is humility. Because only sheep need a shepherd. And so here we come face to face here with why the psalmist prayed. Because they were sheep. And only sheep need a shepherd. People who don't realize that they're sheep, what do they think of a shepherd? I don't need him. Because only sheep need a shepherd. And we can talk, of course, about their inconsistency and how many shepherds they are trying to find from various and sundry locations. But they won't admit that's what they're doing. And it wreaks havoc in their lives, in the world. And so, you know what? When we see that sign, only sheep need a shepherd, I think there's a point at which we say, yeah, you're right. Only sheep need a shepherd. I'm a sheep. I'm a sheep in need of a shepherd. And so we think about Jesus as he looked over, and it's Matthew 9 or 10, right around in there, where it says that he looked out on the crowds and he saw sheep without a shepherd, distressed and downcast. And where their lives were, because they wouldn't admit that they were sheep, needing someone to lead them. And so as long as we're going to think that we can lead ourselves, as long as we can think that we're going to provide for ourselves and we don't need to depend on anyone else, we'll never recognize that in fact we are sheep and we won't have a shepherd, and it's going to be ruined and reckless lives, and of course eternity is going to be miserable. But only when we can have that humility of just being able to say, you're right. Only a sheep needs a shepherd, and I'm a sheep. Because that's what the psalmist saw. Only sheep need shepherds, but we're sheep. And so we need the shepherd. And there's no shame in that when your shepherd is as great as our shepherd is. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. Now, in the Psalms, there's not just a host of psalms that talk about this sheep-shepherd relationship. There's a handful, but there's all over the place in the Psalms statements that are made that present us being just like sheep. Let's think about some things that we need to recognize here. In Psalm 70 and verse 5, what does that say about us? You can probably just shout this one out. Needy. Poor and needy. You know, I need help. That's a sheep. Sheep are poor. They're needy. They can't take care of themselves. So I don't know that psalm says, I'm a sheep. But it says, I'm a sheep. Poor and needy. What about Psalm 88 and verse 4? No strength. I have no strength. And that's one of the problems with the sheep. Again, they have almost no natural defense. About the only thing they can do is kind of the headbutting thing. And you can imagine that while that might be helpful when other sheep are causing a problem, when the mountain lion is attacking, the sheep headbutting is not going to do a whole lot of good. I mean, that's just no strength. Somebody else is going to have to take care of. What about Psalm 33, verses 16 through 19? That one was a little bit harder. I realized after I went back. Go ahead. Only the Lord can save. Yeah, that's the thing I was really wanting us to look at. Here are people that recognize, I can't save me. Hopeless. And it talks about nothing. The kings can't save us. Armies can't save us. War horses can't save us. We can't save us. And that's really the way the sheep are. There's really no hope for a sheep without a shepherd. The other sheep aren't going to be able to save them. And that's the recognition that when I realize that I'm a sheep and you're a sheep, and in reality, even the person carrying that sign is just a sheep, and the president is a sheep, and the kings and queens are a sheep, and the Congress is a sheep, and the governors are sheep. One of the things I recognize is that if I'm going to try to rely on any of them, who am I relying on? I'm just relying on a bunch of sheep. How much defensive power do all those sheep have? Not a whole lot. So there's just really no hope when we're by ourselves just as sheep. And so again, we remember Jesus, the text in Matthew pointing out that he looked out and he saw everyone as sheep without a shepherd, distressed and downcast. In fact, Psalm 42, 5 through 11, what did you get there?
Despair.
One of the reasons I want to bring this one up is because of the little terminology, downcast. Why are you cast down, O my soul? I think it mentions it twice in that psalm. Why are you cast down? My understanding is, and when Jesus talks, or when Matthew describes Jesus seeing them as distressed and downcast, that idea, that term downcast for sheep, is really a word picture that shepherds fully understand. Because here's what sheep will do. Sheep are lazy creatures. And they, you know, like teenage boys, all they want to do is just lay down and play video games. That's it. Okay? And so they're looking for the most comfortable spot in the pasture where they can kind of lean over and eat a little bit and just lay there. And what can happen is their center of gravity while they're laying down can shift. And those little legs are just sitting there. And they can't get their legs back up underneath them. And they just sit there until they are just absolutely exhausted, kicking those little legs. And that is a downcast. That's a cast sheep. A downcast sheep. Another thing that they'll do is, oh, here's a bramble bush, but oh, look at that grass right up underneath there. There's just a little tuft of it, but I'm going to get it because that's what I do. I eat. And so they shove themselves up into that thing. And of course, you know what the sheep have around them, right? All that wool. And it gets caught in the branches. And it gets caught in the brambles. And now they're trying to back out. And guess what they can't do? They can't get out. And they will pull and they will push and they will tug and they will do everything they can until they are absolutely, utterly exhausted. And they collapse. Downcast sheep. And so here, why are you cast down, O my soul? That despair, you know, it's the idea of I have tried everything I know how to try. I have wasted myself and my strength and my energy on all these things. And now I am just cast down. When Jesus, again, saw the folks as sheep without a shepherd, distressed and downcast. That's the image of people who have been pursuing things to try to have some type of meaning, some type of fulfillment, some type of escape from the traps that bind them. And all they end up doing is just utterly exhausting themselves because they don't have a shepherd. And what the shepherd does is comes along and lifts them up. The shepherd comes along and cleans out, helps get them out of the bush or the bramble and sets them back on their feet. He restores my soul. That's what that restoration is. It's that picture of I have wiped myself out chasing bad shepherds, looking just for the next tuft of grass. And it takes the shepherd to come along and fix that. Here we go.
Just can't help but mention this and Psalm 70, verse 5, the New Testament fulfillment or... searching for the right word, but anyway, the words in the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit.
Blessed are the poor in spirit.
For theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Why is it positive to be a sheep? Because it belongs to the kingdom belongs to the poor in spirit. The kingdom belongs to those who recognize we're just sheep. Over here with Kellen.
In the case of the human animal, the shepherd needs a shepherd. which is not true in the realm of sheep. Sheep don't become shepherds. The other interesting aspect about it, I believe, is that you've got probably one of the most courageous leaders in the history of the world who has been the shepherd of a nation, and he sees himself as a sheep.
Yeah, David, the humility there, a king saying, I'm just a sheep. I'm just a sheep. All right, Psalm 141:8, shout that out. What do you got there? Defenseless, easy targets. Psalm 124, of course, that's the whole psalm, but again, that idea of defenseless, easy prey is what I was hoping you would see from that psalm. What about Psalm 119, verse 67 and verse 176? What did you see there? Gone astray, easily going astray. And that's one of the things about sheep, is that despite the fact that here we are in this field and the shepherd has prepared the field and it's lush and it's wonderful and he's moving us around, the sheep looks out through the fence and he sees over there. And of course, the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. And so there they are trying to hedge their way out. And the shepherd, as he's leading them through the path to get to where the good water is, and they sense some water over here, it's nasty, off they go. Easily led astray, easily gone astray, because sheep, we just like to go our own way. Sheep are like that. And what about Psalm 141? What did you get out of that?
I saw it as asking the sheep needs reproof and the sheep needs guarding.
Sheep needs reproof. The sheep needs guarding. What's going to happen if the sheep doesn't get that? Fall. Die. What I get from Psalm 141 is, left to myself, I'm not going to survive. Left to myself, I'm going to die. And so we need the reproof. We need someone coming alongside us. We need the shepherd. So how will seeing myself as a sheep in need of a shepherd help improve my praying? What do you think? Humility. You're the shepherd. Your will be done. You know what is best. I'm just a sheep. I know when I go off on my own way, it's not going to work. And I'm willing to give that up so that mine will be the kingdom. When we recognize ourselves as sheep, it demonstrates the dependence that we have on God. I'll point this out. I can't remember if this is also stated in another lesson. If it is, you get kind of a heads up here. But one of the things in various classes I've been in, just kind of taking people through, well, why do we struggle with prayer? And you get all kinds of, you know, what is it that hinders prayer? And I don't have time. And I'm not sure how to do it. And I'm not, and all these things. But you know what's interesting? When you take those lists and you boil them down, I can tell you what they all ultimately boil down to. What hinders us from praying, for all the little things we might say, what hinders us from praying is not recognizing our absolute, utter, desperate need for God. Because when I recognize my absolute, utter, desperate need for God, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to make time. Because I don't have time to do anything else, because I'm just going to run it. I'm not going to worry too much about, do I know how to do it right or not? Because I recognize my absolute, utter, desperate need, and I'm just going to do the best I can. Think about this. What if you took your child, your son or your daughter, to the doctor? Remember them when they were little and precious and you still liked them? And no, any of your kids, just kid. Your son or your daughter, you took him to the doctor because they'd not been feeling well, and the doctor comes into you and says, I've got bad news. Bad news is, they've got this rare disease. And I got some good news. We actually have a treatment that, in testing so far, has been successful 100% of the time. However, it's still in testing, and so insurance won't pay for it, and it's going to cost you $750,000. Most of us don't have $750,000 lying around. And most of us are now going to go home and try to figure out what on earth are we going to do. And we look across the street and we see the bank there, or we see some people who might be able to help. And we sit there and say, well, I just don't have time to go try to talk to those people about this and try to get their help. Is that what we would say? We'd say, I'm not even sure how to ask somebody for this help. And so I'm just not going to ask anybody for this help. Is that what we would say? No, of course not. In that scenario, we would move heaven and earth because we recognize our absolute, utter, desperate need for the help that these other folks could offer. And we may not have much time. We may have to work because we're trying to make some money ourselves. But we're going to make time to go appeal to the folks we think can help us. And we may say, I don't fully know how to ask this, but what am I going to do? I'm just going to do the best I can. And the reality is that what hinders us most from praying is not recognizing our absolute, utter, desperate need for God. I was teaching a series on prayer at a congregation in a gospel meeting type deal, and we were having some kind of interactive classes, and one person raised their hand and made the comment, and at first I thought, oh, that's really profound, but the more I thought about it, I thought, oh, wait a minute, that's all messed up. Because what the fella said was, you know, one of our big problems in prayer is that we continually ask God to do things that we can do for ourselves. And now that sounds, oh yeah, we shouldn't be wasting God's time with that. Well, let me ask you real quick. So which one of those things is it that we can just do for ourselves? And that's the problem, is that one of the reasons we don't pray very much is because we think there are things that we can do for ourselves. Let me ask you this. Do you think that right now you're breathing because you're just so good at making your lungs go in and out? You know, when I was in high school, they called that an involuntary thing. You know why? Because God set it up that way. If it weren't for God, you couldn't do that. It's not something conscious. I mean, it's something that God designed our bodies to do. In Him we live and move and have our very being. Do you think you got here this morning because you're just so amazing at movement? No, it's because in Him we live and move. And when we recognize that we are sheep, powerless, defenseless, hopeless, left to ourselves, we're just going to die, then prayer ceases to be, well, let me check this off my list today because I'm a Christian and this is my homework. And what it becomes is an absolute, utter, desperate plea that God would be in our lives. There's like I was talking with someone earlier in this week, and for so many of the things that we do as Christians, if we're not careful, we get kind of our motivation wrong. You know, do you have to pray? Well, no, of course you don't have to pray. But I tell you what, you have to pray. You know, do you have to go to church? Well, of course you don't have to go to church. I mean, but you have to go. And see, the problem is we think have to in the sense of, well, is this going to be the requirement for me to get into heaven? Well, not in the sense of here's this checklist of things, and if you do enough of them, you're going to get into heaven. But in the sense of here's the things God's given so you'll survive. Do you think anybody goes out onto the battlefield over in Iraq or in Afghanistan and they go to their commanding officer, do I really have to wear this bulletproof vest? Do you think they do that? Do I really have to wear this helmet while I'm out on the battlefield? I mean, can you? Well, no, I mean, you don't have to, but it's been nice knowing you. And that's the thing. I mean, you don't have to, but if you don't do these things, you're going to die. You know why? Because we're just sheep. We're just sheep, and we've got to remember that. Okay, I'm sorry, I've let myself ramble and let the time get away. Let's talk about being sinners in need of mercy. They recognize themselves not only as sheep in need of a shepherd, but as sinners in need of mercy. And in Psalm 38, 3 through 4, what does the psalmist declare about himself and his sins?
In short, he says he's weighed down and sick with sins.
Weighed down and sick. My sins have come over my head. It's an imagery of drowning. Anybody ever been whitewater rafting? That is absolutely one of the most fun things in the world to do. Until you fall out of the boat. And that's not necessarily bad. Sometimes that can be fun too, unless you're under the boat. I actually ended up under the boat one time. And I know you feel like, oh, that's not a big deal. Let me tell you, that is a huge deal, because this, I don't even know how many miles per hour this boat is being shoved down, but you're in the stream, and so you're under the boat, and your first reaction is to try to kind of get behind the boat, but you can't because the stream is pulling you with the boat underneath it. And so then you're trying to go forward and get out in front of the boat, but you can't because it's being pushed too fast, and you're there underwater, you can't breathe, it's completely, utterly dark, and all of a sudden you realize, I'm going to die because I can't figure out how to get out from under this stupid boat. And you know that air is just 2 feet away, but you can't figure it out. And that happened to me once. As you can see, I did finally calm down enough to figure out, go to the side. So if you're ever underneath the boat, don't get freaked out. Go to the side. You can do that. Okay? It's just not the natural, normal thing that you think of when this is happening. And so, anyway, That's the picture. It's above my head, and it's too much for me to lift up, because you're not lifting that boat. So that's the next thing you start thinking about. I got to push the boat up, and it's not going to happen. It's too much weight. And that's what he's saying about these sins. It's kind of that picture of the water has lifted up above my head, and I can't get up to the air, and it's weighing me down, and I can't get to it. That's what he says about his sin. That's where he is. It's too much for me. I can't deal with it. And I want you to understand that his saying that is not just about I can't get rid of the guilt. It's also that weight of holding him into its servitude. Far too often we only think about the guilt of sin and just hoping we can be forgiven and not thinking about the freedom from sin. And what he's saying is, it's too much for me. I can't get myself free. It's too heavy for me. And of course, he also points out that God punishes and disciplines us because of our sins. We find that in this psalm as well. One of the things I find interesting is that in Romans chapter 3, where we know in verse 23, it says, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. But in that text back in verses, I think like 10 through 19, or 10 through 13, there's six quotes from the Old Covenant, all describing the sinfulness of man. Five of them come from the Psalms. And so when Paul wanted to describe the sinfulness of man, he knew a place where he could go. He could go to a group of people that recognized how sinful they were, and he talked about it. We're kind of running a little bit behind, so let me just kind of run through some of this here. In Psalm 14, verses 1 through 3, basically what it says is, we're all sinners. We've all become corrupt. None has done good. Let me point out to you, though, when it says none has done good, a lot of us are like, what are you talking about? I've done some good. I've done some good. And you have. We've all done some good. But the problem is that none of us have done only good. And that's what he's talking about here. It's not that nobody has ever done anything that could be described as good, because obviously just about everybody has. But the problem is that we have all chosen to turn away from the good multiple times, continually and repeatedly throughout our lives. We have become corrupt. And what that corruption does is that it makes us not good. I mean, think about this. You got a nice, red, delicious apple. But over here on one side, there's this really nasty brown spot and a worm sticking out of it. What do we say about that apple? That's a bad apple. Now, some are kind of weird and they might cut it in half and go ahead and eat the other side. But what are most of us going to do? That's a bad apple. It's corrupt. I'm not even going to try it. I don't know what's all inside this. It's gone. Now, are there good parts in that apple? Well, of course, there are parts that you could cut around and you could just eat that little bit. But when we look at that apple, we don't say, oh, this is a good apple. It's just got this bad spot over here. We say, well, that's a bad apple. And we're just not going to we're not gonna eat that. Well, that's kind of that same thing. Have we done good? Well, of course we have. But the problem is we've got those spots that have worms digging around in them. And what it says is we've become corrupt. In Psalm 5 and verse 9, it's just lies, lies, and more lies. Let me just ask, just for a show of hands, everybody be completely honest, because otherwise you'll be violating the point we're making right now. Anybody here ever told a lie before? Look around. Okay. Yeah. See, there we are. Lies, lies, and more lies. We've all done that. And of course, you remember what happened when you told that little white lie? What did you have to do next? Got to tell another one. And then what did you have to do next? Tell another one. See, the fact is, you're just a liar. You've been a liar. That's where we are. Psalm 140 and verse 3 talks about our tongues being poisonous. The venom of asps underneath our tongues. That could go along with the lying. It could go along with the slander and the gossip. It could go along with the malice that we've had sometimes. Anybody ever said something mean to their spouse before? Yeah, we've all been there. Okay, now here's one. Maybe some of you haven't done that. Any of you ever said something mean to your siblings before? Ah, come on, be honest. Bunch of liars. Except for those of you who are only children. Yeah, we've all done that. We've all done that. So tongues are poisonous. In Psalm 10 and verse 7, mouths filled with cursing and bitterness. You know, the interesting thing about that is you remember that, and my mind just blanked now who it was, whether it was James or John. But James, I think, as he talks about the tongue, hard to control. And the point being made that you can't curse. So James, I think, talks about the tongue that's hard to control. And John is the one who talks about you can't love God whom you haven't seen if you hate your brother whom you have seen. And then James talks about the fact that we praise God, but we curse man with our tongues. And so we've all done that. And John, when he talks about it, equates it with murder. When we say those kind of things about other people. And in Psalm 36 and verse 1, it talks about no fear of God. Oh, got ahead there. Okay. Psalm 36 and verse 1, it talks about no fear of God. Here's the thing that I hope you recognize about this list of passages that we've just gone through that Paul uses in Romans chapter 3. Because if you're like me, you read that list and it's so extreme that what we want to say is, well, I'm not that bad. I mean, look, I know I've done some wrong things. I've done a lot of wrong things, but I'm not that bad. Well, what we need to understand is that Paul, as he's using all that, is not saying you're a sinner when you're that bad. He's saying we're that bad because we've sinned. Well, we need to understand that's his point. He's not saying you become a sinner when you've finally been this bad. He's saying because you're a sinner, you are this bad. And we've got to understand that. We just like having to have the humility to recognize that we're sheep, we need to have the humility to recognize that we're sinners in need of mercy. So how are they going to be able to overcome their sins? This is what this list of passages is dealing with. And didn't necessarily put them in any theological order, so there's kind of some back and forth on it. But we recognize some of the things that they're saying. So in Psalm 5, verses 7 through 8, how do I overcome sin? Because of the abundance of God's steadfast love. Because of the Lord leading us in His righteousness. I think it's important for us to understand when the psalmists talk about overcoming sin, they do not talk about, well, here's what I've got to do. I've got to be really amazingly awesome and overcome sin and then God will love me. They talk about the fact that I want to overcome sin. I need God so that I can. And isn't it great that God loves us and He'll help us? His abundant steadfast love is what it takes to overcome sin. So if what you're wanting to do is, I got to get all this sin stuff taken care of, then I'll come to God because I just don't think I can ever live like a Christian for my whole life. So then I'll come to God. Let me tell you, it's not going to happen. You got to be like the psalmist who understands, I'm a sinner. I need the mercy of God. I need His abundant steadfast love. If I want to overcome this, I need to turn to Him so that He can lead me in paths of righteousness, which actually gets us in with Psalm 23. Psalm 23 talks about, He leads me in paths of righteousness. Does anybody remember why, what the basis is? What's His reason for doing it? He leads me in paths of righteousness for His name's sake. I hope you remember the lesson we had a few Sundays ago on Psalm 23 and that part where we highlighted the central theme of that. He leads me in paths of righteousness, not because I'm awesome, not because I'm great, not because I've done so many wonderful things. And He says, you know what? I'm going to lead you in the right paths because you are just amazing. No, He leads me in paths of righteousness for His name's sake. It's because, here is this shepherd, and there's other shepherds around. That's the word picture. I understand, of course, God is the only God, and there's no other shepherd in that sense. But it's that idea of here's a shepherd among other shepherds, and they're looking at each other's flock. And these false shepherds out here are looking across into the flock, and if they see, and they see in the Lord's flock a bunch of scurvy sheep who's mangy and diseased and sickly and fighting and having all kinds of problems, and what are the other shepherds going to think about God as shepherd? Man, you're a rotten shepherd. For His name's sake, listen, what you need to understand is that God is going to lead you in the right way so that His name can have a great reputation. That's what Moses banked on when he went and prayed to God, please don't destroy these people, because if you destroy them, what are the nations going to say? That's that same idea, for His name's sake. And so, you may not like what God's direction is. You may not like the field God is taking you to. You may not like initially the water. What you need to understand is, look, God's not just doing that because of you. He's doing that to uplift His own reputation. Don't you think you can trust Him? He wants to be seen as a good shepherd. The problem is, of course, in our day and age, it's hard to tell the difference between people who really are living as His sheep and people who just claim it. That's the sad part. Psalm 25, verses 4 through 10, the Lord teaching us His paths, it's the Lord's mercy, it's the Lord choosing not to remember our sins that allows us to have victory. In Psalm 26 and verse 12, the Lord putting us on level ground, that will connect with Psalm 143 and verse 10, which we're going to read in a few moments. It's being on level ground, and it's God's Spirit that does that. Psalm 39, verses 1 through 2, and then also with verse 8, it's God's deliverance is necessary. How are they going to overcome sin? God's deliverance is necessary. I'm not going to overcome it by myself. In Psalm 51 and verse 5, David presents himself there as conceived in sin. And we don't have time to talk about that. This is not his doctoral dissertation on the nature of sin. Okay? He's not saying that we've inherited our parents' sin. It's his snapshot moment of, I recognize I'm so bad, it's if I was just born this way and there's nothing I can do about it. What's he saying? He said, I can't overcome this on my own. That's what he's saying. And then in Psalm 141, verses 3 through 10, God needs to send the proper instruments and tools and help who will help us overcome our sin. And oh, that's Psalm 141. Okay. Yeah, Psalm 143:10 goes along with Psalm 26:12. In Psalm 141, verses 3 through 10, God needs to send the proper instruments and tools, and we need to accept it. If I need it, God, let someone smite me. Let the righteous smite me. Let them just come up and punch me in the face if that's what I need. And let me just accept it as if they were anointing me with oil, because I need the help of God's people to overcome. That's what David said. David said, if the righteous... Think about Nathan, who came and said, you're the man. What David is saying about what Nathan did there is that was just as amazing and wonderful as when Samuel came and anointed my head with oil to be king. Let me just ask you, which would you think was the better day in David's life? Which would you say, ooh, man, I like Samuel a whole lot better. He anointed me with oil and made me king. Nathan's always coming and saying, you're the man. But what David says is, these guys are the same in my book. They're the same. In fact, David named one of his kids Nathan. I don't know if you know that, but he named one of his kids Nathan. All right, so how will seeing myself as a sinner, as the psalmist did, improve my praying? Right down here.
I'm led to think of Luke 18 with the parable of the tax collector and the Pharisee, and how the tax collector prayed, be merciful to me, a sinner. He wouldn't even look to heaven. When we recognize all these things you're talking about, that's how we're going to pray.
Okay. When I recognize that I am the tax collector, I'll pray like the tax collector. Here we go, right down over here. Was that John? Was that...
I think by remembering our past sins, it does keep us humble, and it also continues to arm us against temptation. It makes us willing to serve others, and it makes us to be patient because of the cross, because of what God has done for us. And it seems like, you know, David was always asking to have his sins blotted out or washed or cleansed, and it's like he's telling God, you need to unsin me.
Unsin me. Yeah. Yeah, so the patience, the humility, the need for God is demonstrated here. And only when we recognize our sin. Go ahead.
When we see ourselves as sinners also, it becomes much more difficult to be very judgmental to others. It makes us more humble, more understanding, more forgiving.
Which is going to make us pray for them more, isn't it?
Absolutely, Will.
So here's the person that has sinned against me, and I'm going to be like Stephen. Lord, don't lay this against their charge, because I realize I'm just like them. Okay, lots of things here. It's going to show my desperate need for a loving, merciful, benevolent God. It's going to place me in my proper spiritual place. We got to see ourselves as the psalmist did, guys. Only sheep need a shepherd. And at first, we want to rebel against that. But guess what? When your shepherd is God, that's not such a bad thing. All right, Wednesday night we'll be here praying, and next Sunday we'll be looking at Lesson 7, viewing prayer as the psalmist did. Thank you for your participation.